Hey guys, this is Kevin Estello of Fieldcraft Survival. Just a quick heads up before we get to this podcast. Just want to kind of key you into some training that's coming up. We're going to be at Winkler Knives. This is a brand new location for us. Winkler Knives, I've been good friends with them for years through my SIOC connection. As a SIOC instructor, Dan Winkler obviously makes the SIOC R&D Tomahawk that has been featured prominently on Jack Carr merchandise and all over the Terminalist series that's been on Amazon Prime. We're going to Winkler Knives this November. Jerry Young is going to be teaching modern survival skills November 18th. I will be teaching that day here in Aberdeen, but then I'm driving out that night and I will be teaching land navigation at Winkler Knives Actual in Boone, North Carolina on November 19th, which I'm pretty damn excited. Daniel has been a good friend over the years. I use a number of his knives and I have a collaboration knife with him that's coming out, which I am so excited to share with you guys. Very limited supplies, but it's going to be really cool to be back in Boone, visiting with a good friend. You never know who, by the way, will be in that class. So just keep that in mind. November 18th, Modern Survival Skills. November 19th, Land Navigation coming to Boone, North Carolina. Also, another heads up, we're adding more courses to Utah, Modern Survival courses to Utah. So Jared, who is on Instagram as @ArmyMace, ArmyMace. Jared is a longtime Fieldcraft instructor, solid primitive skills guy, Army veteran. The dude is knowledgeable. He is going to be training out in Utah. Look for him on December 2nd, and he's going to bring it to that course. Guys, this podcast is totally made possible by two of our good sponsors, good friends, Sig Sauer and Hoist Drinks. So let's start off with Hoist. Hoist has been supplying folks here at the Fieldcraft Survival North Carolina Firebase for quite some time. They send us cases of energy drinks, or I should say hydration drinks, as well as some of the other formulas that were specially developed for the military. Hoist is being used by a lot of different people. It's available all over now. You can find it in various supermarkets. I've seen it all over the place, and it tastes really, really good. You know, there are some pretty popular flavors. I'm not going to tell you which one my favorite is, but I'll let you discover yours. Please check them out. That's hoist.com. And it's a great electrolyte replacement drink. So if you're training out in Utah where it gets super hot, if you're training here in North Carolina where it gets super hot, if you are doing physical activity, like sweating a whole bunch, you need to rehydrate. And I recommend that you try out Hoist. And then obviously, anytime that you're using any type of rehydration drink, always mix it with additional water and just get copious amounts of fluids in your body. So with that being said, please check out our good friends at Hoist. The other company I want to recognize is Sig Sauer. I've had the privilege of training at the Sig Sauer Academy so many times. I'm actually currently looking at some of the courses in Florida at the Volusia County Gun Club. There are a lot of opportunities for professional development down there. I'm personally interested in taking the Bullets and Bandages course, but then I'm also interested in doing their Dynamic Performance Pistol. I've done Dynamic Performance Rifle, and it was a gut check how difficult some of the standards are, but it's really important that you always have good standards when you're training. So Sig Sauer, they are top notch when it comes to instruction. I have a lot of good friends that are up at Sig Sauer, a lot of great memories of that academy and learning everything from pistol, carbine, defensive shotgun, and precision rifle up there. So whenever I have the opportunity to just jump into a Fieldcraft class as one of the assistant instructors, I never fancy myself a gun instructor. I always say, hey, I'm just a civilian who is a training junkie, and I've been training for over 2 decades. And I usually say that the three places that I've learned, where I've learned firearms, SIOC Tactical, Gunsight Academy, and of course, Sig Sauer. In Sig, they have had so much of my time, so much of my money, and I'm really, really proud to call that place my alma mater for so many different firearms training. And guys, let's put it this way. You can go to the range and you can practice, or you can go to an academy and get trained. Please get training. Just turning a whole bunch of money into noise is not the same as getting coached by the best in the business. So please check out Sig Sauer. They make fantastic firearms. They've got great training, amazing suppressors. I think it's like a one-stop shop for all of you guys out there that are training junkies just like me. All right. So with that being said, we're going to get to this podcast. But again, thank you so much to Sig. please visit them at www.sigsauer.com. And thank you so much, Hoist, for hydrating us. That is hoist.com, H-O-I-S-T.com. Here we go. Let's get to this podcast. Hey guys, welcome to the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. I'm your host for this episode. My name is Kevin Estella. I'm the director of training over here in North Carolina. Just a quick shout out to all the North Carolina trainers that we got over here. Kate Smith, Adam Neep, Jerry Young, Rick Lofton. All you guys are rock stars. Brian Edwards, we're really crushing it. If you guys want to get some training in here on the East Coast, please come and check us out. We got everything coming up with LandNav. We've got Jerry's emergency medical course. Rick Lofton's doing vehicles. Kate's probably going to do plants again. I'm doing survival. So we got a whole bunch of stuff coming up. And don't forget defensive shotgun, which we're going to try to get our guest on the podcast today out to at some point. But big shout out to those guys. And please check out Fieldcraft Survival Training to see where you guys can get educated. So let's talk about today's podcast. You probably have to be living under a rock to not hear about the movie called The Sound of Freedom. And if you've ever traveled to a highway rest stop, you've probably seen there or in airport bathroom signs that say, if you are traveling without your consent, if you're traveling under the oppression of someone else, please do this alert so-and-so. Well, there's no doubt about it that trafficking of all sorts, it doesn't just have to be child trafficking, it can be adult trafficking as well. It exists in the world. And today is going to be an interesting podcast because my podcast guest is the foremost expert or subject matter expert in it. And I'll tell you, it's overwhelming when you hear the numbers. I mean, I just looked at an article that he sent me yesterday. And when you think about it, every one of those numbers has an individual story, which could be overwhelming in of itself. So with that, I want to introduce Dr. Jason Piccolo, a solid individual, someone that you should pay attention to. So Jason, how you doing, my friend?
Hey, well, first off, you had me sold on defensive shotgun.
Yeah, that's, I'll tell you, man, that is one of the most fun classes. And, you know, having gone through it on both sides, you know, a student and an instructor, I really just enjoy running the shotgun. It's a visceral firearm. It makes you giggle. It is capable of defending yourself against any animal in North America, and you can take almost anything off, you know, God's earth, birds, small game, big game, dangerous game. It's just a capable platform. So we enjoy it.
I love the shotgun. You know, my background is kind of a little bit interesting because I had, like, you know, this month is 30 years. Whether it be the army or law enforcement, and the shotgun has just always been my favorite, I think.
You sound just like Jerry. Jerry would say that when he would get called out as SWAT, or, you know, he'd get called out active shooter, whatever it was, instead of grabbing the AR, he would always grab the shotgun. So you two are going to get along just fine when you guys jump on that podcast. I know that's coming up at some point, but let's talk about your background, because it's interesting to say the least. You said 30 years combined federal law enforcement and military. So, I mean, yep. Where did it all begin?
Well, let me tell you, it began in the Appalachian Mountains. But no, really it did, because I grew up in a small town in New Jersey, right off the Appalachian Mountains. You know, my whole life, I always wanted to either be a soldier or a cop. But I decided, hey, you know, why not be both? So what I did was, in the 90s, I joined the Army. I was enlisted. I was a 13 Bravo. Got out, went to college, and did, at the same time went to the National Guard, did human intelligence, commissioned as an infantry officer in 99. But then I said, hey, you know what? I want to get in law enforcement. So rather than going active duty, I went into the U.S. Border Patrol in January of 2000. Did that for about 2.5 years, did a whole bunch of different units on there, ATVs, mountain unit, Mexican liaison for my shift. Then I became a special agent with the former U.S. Customs, which eventually becomes HSI, and worked a counter-drug proactive narcotics group in the high-intensity drug trafficking area in San Diego. And then Uncle Sam decided that he needed me back, and I went, got recalled as an infantry officer, and eventually ended up in Iraq, attached to the Combined Joint Special Operations Task Force as an anti-terrorism officer. Got out of the Army as a captain in 06 when I came back from the war. And then I went to work for DOD working Gitmo stuff for a while. Then I went to work for DOD working like admin and munition list item type stuff. Then I went to work for ICE for a bunch of years. with ICE. I was a deportation officer, then a supervisor. Then I went to headquarters and worked at the worked at their operations. I was an acting unit chief for a while, acting chief of staff. Then I went over to the human smuggling cell, which is part of the White House Security Council's kind of a macro level program. Our goal was to disrupt and dismantle, you know, the smuggling organizations bringing people across the border. And then I ended up my career with the Environmental Protection Agency, believe it or not, as an associate special agent in charge, senior intel advisor. So very varied background over the past 30 years. And I retired in March. And yeah, man, I've been doing a bunch of different things here and there, you know, with the podcast, I teach college, just, you know, shooting a lot of stuff, brother.
You know, it's funny because you look at your background and I'm thinking of like how we're going to write up this podcast at you as the guest. And it's like, okay, well, do we talk about, you know, you and the National Guard? Do we talk about you and Homeland Security? Do we talk about you and ICE or Border? I mean, the list goes on and on. I mean, what do you consider, like, what was the longest stint that you did? Like, what are you like, where did you have the longest stay in all those organizations?
Well, Homeland Security for sure. And, you know, the reason I left Homeland Security was kind of not in the nicest avenue, I should say. Mm-hmm. Usually, typically when you Google my name, it'll come up Jason Piccolo, whistleblower.
No kidding.
So when I was at, yeah, so it's like we were charged back in the day. So in 2015, I was assigned to a human smuggling cell. I was mentioning before how we were, our goal was like work at the strategic level to disrupt and dismantle the criminal organizations that were smuggling people across the border, specifically the unaccompanied alien children. So little kids getting smuggled across the border. And in the realms of like probably since the beginning of this whole crisis, probably since 2011, 2012, likely close to a million or over a million children brought across the border. And yeah, some are teens and some are, you know, on both sides of the aisle, you're going to say, well, there are gang members integrated in there. But for the majority of them, they're really, you know, under 13, tender age type kids. And people are bringing unaccompanied. I mentioned unaccompanied. They're bringing kids that are like solo across the border. And if you want, I can kind of explain how that goes and kind of how this fits into the whole trafficking realm.
Well, I mean, I think you piqued my interest, and I'm sure some people would like to know about the whistleblowing, like without going into too much detail or as much as you can, like what was the, what was that you were exposing?
Well, let's say there's children are coming from Central and South America. They're bringing smuggled up to the border. And then when they get to the border, they're put into custody, either, you know, someone at a port of entry, a customs and border protection officer, or a border patrol agent outside of the ports of entry. When they come into our custody, into the U.S. custody, you know, they're processed, they're handed over to ICE. ICE transfers them over to a non-law enforcement entity called Health and Human Services Office of Refugee Resettlement, ORR. And then ORR will either take direct custody of them or transport them over to a contracted facility. Now, there's contracted facilities all over the country, so they're not necessarily giving me on the Southwest border. That's why in the news you'll see, you know, flights of kids being transported over the country. So when they get to these facilities, they only have a certain amount of time. I believe it's like, you know, within a certain few weeks, they have to be given over to a sponsor. Now, the sponsors are just people in the U.S., not necessarily family. So you have hundreds of thousands of children that are handed over to one. You're supposed to have different levels of sponsors, one being a family, two being a close family relation or, you know, second, third cousin type thing. And then they have non-familial relations. So what I found was when I was working for the cell is one of my coworkers sent me a spreadsheet. And on a spreadsheet, it had 29,000 sponsors. I'm like, okay, well, what's going on here? Well, what was happening was when these children were being handed over to sponsors, the sponsors weren't being vetted. They weren't being checked for criminal history. Their fingerprints weren't being taken. And quite frankly, they weren't being checked up on after they got handed over to these sponsors. Well, the sponsor list I got was a sampling of 29,000 sponsors. Out of, at this point, there's probably 200,000 or 300,000 sponsors. of 29,000, 3,400 plus had criminal records or criminality, including sex offenders. So essentially, the government was just handing children over to unvetted people who may or may not have nefarious reasons for having them. So the spreadsheet was dated July. By the time I got it, it was August. So I went to my supervisors and I said, hey, you know what? We're the human smuggling cell. We're at the headquarters level. Why aren't we doing an operation to get these kids back into custody? All of them, or at least the ones who weren't vetted. And at this point, none were being vetted, the sponsors. And it kind of fell on deaf ears. So I decided I'm going to legally blow the whistle. Wow. I didn't leak any information. I went to the U.S. Office of Special Counsel and said, hey, you know what? This is what's going on, and we need to do something about it. And that just became a very interesting avenue for me to do, is become a whistleblower. At this point in my life, I've had, you know, it was 93 to, you know, with active duty reserves, and then 2000, 2015. So I had, you know, a bunch of years in the government. Couldn't retire, so I kind of knew my career would be over if they found out who I was. So I anonymously blew the whistle, but then eventually they discovered my identity, and they terminated me from that detail.
Wow. You know what? It is so interesting with that aspect of people not being vetted, is it sounds to me like it's very similar to the adoption process, in that, you know, with adoption, adoptive parents have to go through such incredible scrutiny before they're given a child. And yet with this process, it seems like they're just handed over. There's almost nothing. Which, why is there one standard for adoption and another standard for that? Like, have you ever wondered, or I'm sure you have, who stands to gain from not doing this the correct way? Like, what is the reason why it's still persisting?
Well, there's a few different reasons. Timeliness is huge. You don't want to have the optics that its children are to be in quote unquote custody by the U.S. government when they could be out of custody. Two is these contracted facilities. The contracted facilities are multi-million dollar business. It's a huge business. I believe, and this, don't quote me directly, but I believe there's two facilities in Texas that were handed like $20 or $30 million contracts just to do unaccompanied children. So there's money involved. And then it's really, you know, when you have a million plus people coming across the border a year now, you can't put anybody in custody, and then here you are, you're going to be looked at as putting the children in cages, kids in cages and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So that's one of it. And the nefarious reasons, I don't know for sure what's going on, but a lot of these kids are getting recycled. So adults will use the children to get across the border, because back they used to make family units out of them. So they would pair children up with an adult. Now, this is a little bit different than an unaccompanied children thing, but just going on at the same time. They would pair a child up with an adult, then an adult would act like their family. And then you can't keep family units in custody for, I believe it's more than 20 or 21 days under this Flores agreement, they call it. And then they would send those kids back down south and be used again. So, I mean, there's so much to do. You're finding these kids, not just sex trafficked, but you're finding them in labor. Trafficking is big now. So they're using these kids for everything you could possibly imagine. I mean, the government is technically smuggling children and trafficking children.
In that article that you sent me last night, the crux of it was that they have no capability of tracking kids once, or not just kids, anyone, once they cross the border. Like, they're not keeping track of people when they come across the border. And I mean, they don't know where they're populating. They don't know what actions they're doing. And, you know, I hate to say it, but
brother,
yeah, go ahead.
I'm going to tell you something right now. The problem with everything we're talking about, that wasn't even an article. So this is the Department of Homeland Security. This is an official report. Please share it. The Department of Homeland Security's Office of Inspector General pretty much called ICE on the carpet. It said, hey, DHS does not have assurance that all migrants can be located once released into the United States. Now, it's a redacted report. I did receive this from the state of Florida, because we'll go into my testimony in a minute. But this is an actual 35-page OIG report from going to Secretary Mayorkas, Department of Homeland Security, and also to Corey Price from Enforcement Removal Operations from ICE, coming from the actual Inspector General of the DHS. And if you read this report, man, it is crazy. It's not only have they lost the children that they can't accompany for, but like they can't accompany for like hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people coming across the border. Now, the attorney that sent this to me pretty much said, hey, you know what? You need to take a look at page 16. So if anybody's reading this report, we're going to go to page 16. I'll read this off to you right now. It's crazy, brother. Finally, DHS may unknowingly release migrants, including children, to potentially unsafe conditions or smuggling operations, with the number of migrants released into the United States increasing because USBP must release migrants in cases when the migrant does not have an address or it is uninhabitable. Address validation will likely remain a challenge. So this is directly from a DHS OIG report. This isn't the news. This isn't anybody else coming up with anything. If you read this report, it's going to be the OIG, the watchdog of DHS, saying, we recommend you do all of these things. And ICE came back after these recommendations and said, we don't concur with these recommendations. Because essentially what's happening is all these people are coming across the border and they're losing them. There's no addresses, there's no phone numbers, there's no way to track them. So when these kids are released, HHS or the contract facility will essentially call up that address or call them up or maybe do a drive-by. But everybody's in the wind, brother.
The word that stands out to me in that final statement is may. And I always see that as like, you know, well, they may release them, meaning like there's a doubt or there's a possibility, but they're not saying that it's actually happening. There's not a certainty. And I think that's what's allowing them that gray area to get by, allowing this to happen, where they're like, well, there's a possibility that it does, but there's also a possibility that it doesn't, right? There's that one word may, as opposed to this does happen on occasion. Because if you were to have that written in there, I don't see how anyone could argue with that. But yet they just let it slide because they're like, well, it's a possibility, but it's not a guarantee. Because I mean, I'm sure there are. I mean, let's face it. There probably are good families that are taking in these migrants.
Absolutely.
And they're definitely doing what they need to do as good Americans. Totally get that. But the ones we're talking about are the ones, like you said, that are not screened for being sex offenders. And then what happens to those kids? And I know the argument when I was a high school history teacher, I always used to get into arguments when I would hear people say, well, you know, in all these school shootings, if we could just save one kid. And I was like, Why aren't we arguing to save every kid as opposed
every
to just
kid,
one additional or all kids? Here's what we can do. So, I mean, it seems like the correct action would be full stop. Guess what? We're closing down that border until we can get a system in process. You guys have to just hold out, but we'll guarantee your safety once we have this process in order. But yeah, that was eye opening when I read that.
Well, you know
what's
crazy? Yeah. So when I blew the whistle, so what happened was I kept going back and forth and back and forth with Health and Human Services anonymously. So then I eventually said, okay, look, here's the deal. Because Health and Human Services was telling me the spreadsheet I gave to the Office of Special Counsel was skewed. You know what was skewed on it? Because I downloaded onto a thumb drive, the Excel spreadsheet wasn't lined up correctly. But all the data, it was exactly what was sent to me by senior leaders. So I said, look, I'm going to explain this to HHS. So I get on the phone with HHS. I'm anonymous, but I say, hey, I want everybody on this line. I want your name, your numbers and everything else, your phone, your names and everything. Not your numbers, but your names and identifying information. During this, they kept going, look, your spreadsheet doesn't work. We did a sampling. We think it's wrong. Their sampling of 29,000 people. They took 25 names off of that list. And they said, well, three of them had potential criminals. So out of 29,000 people, they only sampled 25. So it was crazy at that point. And I said, look, they're like, well, how do you know this information is correct? I'm like, it's your information. I work closely with the human smuggling cell. And I'm a certified fraud examiner. And when I said that, I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah, because you know, you just revealed yourself.
I'm the only CFE on there. Literally the next business day, I went into the the cell, they terminated my detail and sent me back to headquarters.
Wow.
Now, that same month that they terminated my detail, and they were trying to say that it was I wasn't working out. Well, I received the ICE Director's Award for my time on the actual ICE Director's Award at the time. I actually wrote the business plan and charter for the cell. So, I mean, it wasn't like there wasn't a cause. It was just like, okay. That's when I went to Senator Charles Grassley's office. Now, Grassley actually called everybody on a carpet, and months later, they started vetting the sponsors. They started taking fingerprints. They started vetting them. They started doing, I don't know if they're from me, but they started doing rapid DNA analysis. In March of 2022, because of the massive influx, they stopped doing all that stuff. So I did affect change for a little while, but now they stopped doing it, man. So the state of Florida flew me down last January to testify in a grand jury. And what they're doing is they're going after these contractor facilities for essentially trafficking children.
Yeah.
So I gave testimony to the grand jury down there, and we'll see what happens with that. But it's just states are trying to take the law, and they're trying to do the right things for the sponsors, not for the sponsors, but for the kids. Because at the end of the day, we're talking about a lot of people don't understand, like unaccompanied children are like, some of them are babies. They're literally handed over. There was video last year of smugglers just dropping kids off on the other side of the fence, like 6-year-olds, 4-year-olds. I mean, just amazing the tender age children, the thousands of tender age children coming across the border, brother.
Wow. Sorry for the background noise, guys. It seems like our landscapers that are at our facility here, it seems like they decided today was going to be the day to run the weed whacker. So I mean, as I mentioned in the intro, it seems like this problem is so overwhelming. I mean, thousands and thousands. And when you tell me, hey, they took a sampling, like a segment of the population, like a random sampling, and it seems like data-driven decision-making. And they're hoping that they're going to get the best sampling, so it doesn't show the entire picture, which sounds just like public education. Like when a teacher wants to show that they're highly effective, they take the best kids as opposed to their worst performers. And they show, well, these best kids are, you know, they're excelling in all the standardized testing and whatnot. With all these numbers that are undeniable, in my opinion, I mean, where do we begin to address this? Like if you were given carte blanche capability to do what you need to do, how do you address this?
Well, first of all, just like you said, full stop. We need to vet these sponsors, whether that's, and I'm not talking just fingerprints. If they're coming in and they're saying that they're going to be a familiar relation, then you do rapid DNA. You know, you do the rapid DNA and that takes a few hours, boom, you determine whether or not they have a familial relation. If you have to release a child to someone who's not a familial relation, then they need the sponsored adult needs to be put on an ankle bracelet or have some sort of GPS tracking. It's called alternatives to detention. It's sort of like, you know, I mean, because think about it. If you go through such scrutiny to become a foster parent, I mean, not such scrutiny, but it's a lot harder to be a foster parent than it is just to show up and fill out a few documents. All of a sudden, I got a kid or three. You need to verify these addresses. If you're not going to put them on GPS locator, you at least need to have some way to verify that these children are in a safe haven. Wow. So that's the other thing. And then other than that, you really need to just closely monitor the children, where they are, make sure they're not ending up not just in sex trafficking or in nefarious means, but labor trafficking as well.
Hey y'all, Amber Ale here, and today I want to talk to you about teeth. So I know this seems like an off topic here, but it's actually not. When you are focused on health and wellness as a priority in your self-reliant lifestyle, like I do in my home, your teeth really do get a spotlight. And so ever since my kids were little, I wanted an option for fluoride, a safer alternative than fluoride, because I knew that fluoride was not the best solution for what I wanted in my kids in their prophylactic lifestyle, which means preventative lifestyle. And so I settled on a substance called nanohydroxyapatite, and I've used it for years. It's actually a biomimetic substance, which means it has the same material in it that's found in your teeth and your bones. And now has been touted by the American Dental Association as a safe alternative to fluoride. It even has medical applications outside of dentistry, and it's been proven to be as effective as fluoride at remineralizing your teeth. So we found this brand called No BS, literally only the good stuff, No BS, and we are giving you 15% off your first 1 month supply of No BS. It's a small 1 month jar that you use to brush your teeth. So I know it's not paste in a tube, it's a jar that has the nanohydroxyapatite that you use on a brush to clean your teeth. You can find out more by visiting www.betterbiome.com and using the code FIELDCRAFT. That's FIELDCRAFT. If you're interested in learning more about how to have a prophylactic lifestyle with your oral health and you want an alternative to fluoride, definitely go check them out.
You know, I don't have much experience with undocumented or, you know, kids that are, you know, under this umbrella that we're talking about right now. I mean, I definitely, when I was a teacher, taught kids who had parents who were not here legally in the country, and, you know, they confided in me that information and all that. How do people recognize that something nefarious is happening in their neighborhood? Because it seems like this is something that the listener might be interested in. Like, you know, I want to do something. I don't know what I could do. I'm not a government official. Like, what could the average person do? Because, I mean, it seems like in this society that we're in now, right, we used to say, if you see something, say something. But now if you say something, you might be labeled a racist, a bigot, you know, whatever it may be. Like, what is the correct course of action if someone assumes that there's something going on with kids that are being housed illegally for different reasons or whatever? Like, what would you do?
Well, you know, there's two different camps in this. There's mm-hmm. the domestic trafficking, and then there's international trafficking. Now, when it comes to the unaccompanied children, it's going to be very tough. There's going to be language barriers. There's going to be, unless you're someone in a community and someone that could tell that there's something nefarious going on, you know, like, let's say you have a house that has, you know, 10, 15 people living in it, all sorts of different children, co-locating in the same location. It's not going to necessarily mean it's trafficking, but when these sponsors are all using the same addresses, and then these children aren't going to school, they're not being clothed and housed. A lot of times when it comes to the international trafficking, like with the unaccompanied children, it could look a lot different than domestic. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, if they want to help, listen, you can see the movies, you can see a lot of the vigilante type operations that people suspect is going to be work, but vigilantism does not work. It's so true. It absolutely does not work. You have to work with law enforcement. And you have to work with, you know, what the resources you have are. Because if you do have suspect someone of being a trafficker, you can't just go snatch a kid and say, oh my gosh, this kid's being trafficked. We got to help him, because you don't know. You have to identify, take notes. It's just like whenever you do surveillance or anything like that. A lot of people see things going on. You know, you can have someone in your neighborhood that looks out of place, and you're always looking at like, huh, do the same thing with this. Take a license plate down. Identify what you think might be potentially and contact law enforcement. Hmm. Now, law enforcement is not always cognizant. They're not always readily available. But keep hammering it. Go to the locals, go to the states, go to the feds. If you don't get any action there, then you have to contact your local council, start the councilmen, senators, everything. But you have to raise the alarm. Someone's going to listen. They have to listen. If they don't, then you have to go. You have to do what you have to do. Snatching kids and you know, removing them from a potentially hostile instance may actually get you in trouble. So you got to watch that kind of stuff. Now, one thing I'm really adamant about is, I mean, we could switch topics into domestic trafficking.
Yeah.
Domestic trafficking is huge, brother.
Yeah. I think there are people listening, and I'm sure there are people in America. I know there are people in America that say, well, this is a southern border state issue. Yet you see all the major metropolitan areas where it's very easy to live in anonymity, right? You go to New York, you go to Chicago, even Boston, you go to New York, Chicago, Boston, DC, you go anywhere where there's a large metropolitan area and you can disappear. And there are reports of a lot of people coming into these areas. I mean, is there... like one hotbed right now that you would say like, wow, this city has like the fastest growing population of undocumented? Or, I mean, is there somewhere where that people should be on the lookout?
Well, you can't really be on the lookout, man, because it's everywhere. It's literally everywhere.
Yeah.
It's not even in big cities anymore. Because what happens is like, so you'll take, let's say you take 10,000 people, you send them to New York. Mm-hmm. Well, they'll land in New York, but they don't necessarily have to stay there. They'll go to where they're going to feel comfortable, where they're going to be, you know, not under scrutiny of law enforcement. Obviously, ICE priorities right now aren't going after just, they're pretty much here. Because a lot of times when people are released into the country, let me backtrack. Mm-hmm. A lot of people who are released into the country now are provided with a notice to appear in NTA. It's a document saying, okay, eventually you're going to end up into an immigration proceedings. Until they get officially ordered removed, they pretty much have free movement throughout the country. So you can pretty much find anybody anywhere unless they conduct a criminal act. That's the only time they're ever going to really end up being encountered. But because they have this piece of paper in NTA, they can pretty much go anywhere they want. So they're going to go to where, you know, if we're just talking about undocumented, they're going to go anywhere, anywhere where they can get jobs, anywhere where they can live, anywhere they can get the fiscal support.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to the children are going to be sent to a contracted facility before they get released to a sponsor. The problem with that is it's tough. Like I'm on the HHS.org website or HHS.gov website right now. And just trying to find a list of contracted facilities, good luck. But HHS on here does say that since the influx, this is quote, ORR has provided care for and found suitable sponsors for over 410,000 unaccompanied children. And this is as of this month, according to their fact sheet. 410,000 children released into the country to quote unquote suitable sponsors. How could we possibly determine where they are at?
Right.
And there's no way.
And as you mentioned,
and when
that
you talk
memo,
about just one children, mm-hmm. one child, there's no way.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, and I said before, that memo says that we can't track them. So even thinking back on that question that I just asked you, like, where's the greatest area that's receiving growth? There is no answer because you can't track them. Like you said, they're all over. Now you talked about briefly this idea of domestic trafficking, and that's mm-hmm. a distinction that needs to be made, right? Like we need to talk about international and domestic, and the domestic I think is even more frightening because it's homegrown. So
absolutely homegrown.
So
and that is what the most alarming thing is.
Mm-hmm. So how do they perpetrate that?
Well, you know, fortunately, you know, before I'm here, I live in Virginia. Mm-hmm. And I was able to, like, you know, go sit down on some really, really interesting topics and conversations with families and with women and with parents who have been either their children have been trafficked or they have been trafficked themselves. And a lot of it comes down to just grooming.
Mm-hmm.
Online grooming, in-person grooming, you know, and it can happen to everyone. You know, I have teenagers now and I'm cognizant of their social media activity and stuff, but you just don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, you literally, and you know, here's what happens is a trafficker is it's domestic slavery. It's industrialized rape. I hate the word trafficking because you could traffic drugs. You could traffic this. You could traffic arms, traffic people, but it doesn't really explain what it really is. It's industrialized rape. You're moving one body. You're using a person as a commodity to make a profit, mm-hmm. a criminal profit, illicit profit. So you have traffickers who are scanning social media all day long. This is their job. You know, they're part of their, it could be a one person. It could be a group of people. It could be a network. But this is their job. They scan social media. They look for the post that said, oh, man, really lonely today. Oh, man, my parents just don't understand. And they key on them. They key in on that kind of topics. And it's a long game for them. Right. They'll be doing this with 3 or 4 or 5 different children at the same time. Girls primarily, but boys as well. And they're trying to bring them like, hey, you know, I understand. And they build this relationship with them. And then eventually it comes out to, hey, let's meet, let's do this. When they meet, it could be, hey, you know what? It's perfectly fine. They meet a few times. They start saying, hey, you know what? I'm going to give you expensive things, or I'm going to give you your own phone. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. And then, and this is just some cases they'll take, hey, send me nudes, send me this. They'll get compromising pictures. And then they'll be like, then they start wheeling them in saying, hey, I'm going to release those pictures to everybody. I'm going to do this and do that. Another thing is they'll say, hey, you know what? Either you're going to do this for me, or I'm going to kill your parents, kill your brother, kill this. And these are direct stories. This isn't just me making this up. These are stories from survivors and from parents. So this is happening everywhere. You have groomers everywhere. And when they bring these, and they'll take a child, and then they'll turn that child and have that child recruit other children, other teens, other younger children. And it's not just the grooming, it's familial trafficking. Mm-hmm. You have parents, uncles, adults selling their own children. And this is reality. This is the reality of America. This is the reality of the world, but this is happening in your, not necessarily, I'm not saying it's happening in every neighborhood, but I guarantee it's happening in every town. You're not really safe and secure anywhere from trafficking. But the thing is, you shouldn't consider yourself safe and secure, because if you do, then you're like, well, that's someone else's problem. You have to consider this your problem. That's how you can get involved, is you say, hey, you know what? What are they doing in my town? What is law enforcement doing in my town? And if law enforcement says trafficking is not happening here, they're lying to you. Mm-hmm. And if your politician says trafficking isn't happening to you here right now, either their head's in the sand or they're lying to you as well, because they don't want to say, hey, you know what? If it's happening here, then we're not the perfect utopia that we live in. So it's happening. There are ways to get involved, and there are ways to identify for your children. And the big thing is identify that it is a problem. It is happening here. And have discussions with your children. I talk to my kids all the time. Like, and they give me that look, Dad. But it's true. I mean, it's happening. It could be happening in their schools. It could be happening to their friends. You just don't know.
You know, I think the most infamous example of trafficking, domestic trafficking, was what is it, Ghislaine Maxwell, right? And Ghislaine Maxwell, and then Jeffrey Epstein.
Oh yeah.
You know, and there was obviously Epstein Island, that was, you know, what was it, St. John, where that was taking place. It was in the Caribbean. But then there was examples of that happening here, you know. And personally, yeah, I'll say this, like I dated a girl for a while who I suspected of being the victim of a groomer. No doubt about it in my mind, because, you know, he gave her, you know, fancy things and, you know, provided a dependency. And, you know, the question was she under 18 or over 18 when they started their quote unquote relationship? And he was an older guy. There's no doubt about that. And I looked at this guy's social media one day and I was like, this guy's a misogynist. And it was interesting mm-hmm. to see how the, you know, this ex of mine was like, oh no, he's a really nice guy. And I'm like, whoa, hold on. Like, look at this photo that he's putting up on social media. You're saying that's a nice guy. Like, there was a certain level of brainwashing, I thought, to the point mm-hmm. where she said, you know, oh, I was in love with him, but I wasn't attracted to him. I'm like, that's a strange statement. And then, you know, whenever, like you said, attention seeking, like very much putting out there to the world, like, hey, this is how I feel. Like, I'm assuming that if she did that now, she did that back then when she was with this guy. And my God, I mean, the whole grooming thing, once I started looking into it to try to figure out like how I could provide some help, like sometimes the damage is so like it's so severe that some people might not even be able to be repaired or fixed or helped or, you know, because there was nothing I could do, nothing I could say to prove like, okay, this is what happened. Like, she believed that this guy was like the nicest guy in the world. I'm like, look right here, you know, and then you bring up the examples like, okay, here's an article on grooming and, you know, they hone in on someone who has a need and then they take them away from their family. And then like you bring up all these examples, all these red flags. Oh no, that's not how it was. And then it's like, okay, that's gaslighting. It's like, yes, it was. You're trying to tell me something else. But it does happen. I mean, like I said, limited experience seeing it in my own life. But I've heard of plenty of examples of people who said, you know, this person was recruited by someone to join this group over here. And it's like, well, how do they recruit them? Well, they were in a vulnerable time in their life. Like, my gosh, like you said, if you pay attention to social media, you can pretty much follow the breadcrumbs to something really, really dark. And it doesn't have to be at the level of like a Jeffrey Epstein, but it could be something that is equally damaging on a small scale. And there's many examples of that.
Well, you know, the biggest thing, you brought up a couple things here, was help. You could help in the community. I mean, a victim of trafficking, you know, whether it's a child or an adult, they need resources to get out. And we're not talking about just throwing money at them. We're talking about, like, find out your local areas who are helping the victims become survivors. I mean, that's the other big thing, is like, what is your town doing for survivors? What are they doing to help these people get to the next level so they don't end up back being on the street or being trafficked again? Mm-hmm. And then the other thing too, is you have to have open communication with your kids. I suck sometimes, believe me, especially when you're dealing with teenagers, but you have to. I remember, like, what I saw mother speak about how her daughter was like straight A's. This one boy came into school, started giving her a lot of attention. He was popular. Turns out he was part of a gang. And this is reality right here. He brought her to a party, and this is after he groomed her a bit. Mm-hmm. Brought her to a party, and they ran a train on her and videoed it. And then they said, "Hey, we're gonna release this to your parents. We're gonna do this or that." And then they said, "Even if your parents try to do anything, we're gonna kill them." Brought her into the world, tattooed her up, and next thing you know, she's lost. This is reality, man. I mean, we know there's great people out there. There's really good people doing great things. But there are some evil people out there, without a doubt, evil. And they are looking. And it's almost like, you know, the old advertising thing. You got to tell people fear. I think it's more of like, you need to just be able to have an open mind that evil is out there. You don't have to, like, you know, close your mind and lock everything off and live in a, you know, with armed guards everywhere. But, you know, you just have to realize that evil's out there and will take advantage of anybody they see that they can. It's money to them. It's absolute money. It's power, money. And it's just, they don't look at human beings as anything other than a commodity. And to me, that's evil.
You know, something I think about what we say during like our personal security classes and during the survival classes about mindset and just being honest with yourself. And recently a friend of mine, he goes by Bill Brasky on social media. You guys might know him, law enforcement guy from Connecticut, West Hartford PD. He was talking about how there are so many people out there that overestimate their capability. They're just not honest with themselves. And he posted up an article about Joe Rogan going after some guy who said he could take Joe Rogan, and Joe Rogan ended up like tapping him out like 8 times or something like that. But there are people out there who are not honest with the reality of the world. And you hear people say, well, that could never happen here. It's like, well, it could never happen until it does. And that's an expression people need to remember. Like in my home state of Connecticut back in 07, I want to say it was 07, Dr. Bill Pettit, his family experienced one of the worst heinous crimes I've ever seen, where the wife and daughters were raped and murdered, the house was burnt, and you know, those two criminals that perpetrated those acts, they were subject to the death penalty until Connecticut revoked the death penalty, and then that's what caused Dr. Pettit to go back and become an advocate for the death penalty and try to reverse it. But there are so many people out there that just say, well, that could never happen, or you know, oh, those things don't happen here. So to the people who say that those things don't happen here, it doesn't sound like this type of domestic trafficking is limited to just one neighborhood. Like, is there like a preponderance of like one class of people or one type of people? Like, is there a typical, you know, like a profile of like what a groomer is, or is it mostly male, mostly female?
Well, that's the thing too, is like, yeah. Grooming is like, you know, the typical profile is anybody who's, you kind of mentioned before, like a little bit misogynist, dominant, but they could, a master manipulator, but it could be any race, any creed, anything. Trafficking is just, it's all over. Like, a lot of people don't realize, like, a lot of prostitution is trafficking. A lot of the massage parlor stuff is trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're trying to say it's prostitution is a victimless crime, well, the victim is a person being trafficked, you know? So it's like, the thing is, like, it can happen anywhere. It can happen in the multi-million dollar neighborhoods. It can happen in, you know, the drug infested neighborhoods, obviously, because where crime is there's money. But it's just, it's happening everywhere.
Yeah, I think in the 80s.
White, black, Asian, everything.
I want to say it was the 70s or the 80s in Greenwich, Connecticut. They had what they called the Key Club. And the Key Club was wife swapping, where in these multi-million dollar mansions, you'd have all these different socialites get together and they would throw their car keys into a bowl. And then they'd pull out the car keys and the guy would be like, okay, whose are these? And then the wife would go forward. I mean, and I don't know if the wives volunteered for it, probably not, or if that was just their thing. I don't know what you want to call it, but proof right there. I mean, the commodity was the wife, you know, and then there are examples, like you said, of this happening and, you know, in gangs. And we just had these two guys come and visit, and you know them, BC and Ski. And man, mm-hmm. those two guys, oh my gosh, did they open eyes. And we want to start hosting them more. We'd love to get you out here for one of those events where it's just to have like a summit for law enforcement or concerned citizens. Like, this is what you can see. This is what you can do. This is how you can help. These are the telltale signs that it's happening in your neighborhood. I mean, it is a massive, massive issue. And I think the one of the best things we can do, like you said, apart from the vigilante stuff, which probably not the safest thing in the world, is just be super alert. And so what if you call the police and say, look, I think something could be happening. I'd rather live with the allegation, oh, you're just being overprotective. I'd rather be that than saying like, man, this is happening under my nose.
99% of law enforcement has a non-emergency line.
Yeah.
Call it up. Say, hey, look, here's what's going on in my neighborhood.
Wow.
You know, if you don't want to call, write them a letter, shoot them an email, go to their social media.
Mm-hmm.
There's a million ways to connect. What I'd love to see is some sort of intelligence analysis for every town, like an open source one, where you could find out what's going on in your town, what's really going on in your town.
Mm-hmm.
And not just like, you know, Karen talk, but like, you know, the nosy neighbors sometimes have some really good intelligence. So have some sort of open area where you could actually, you know, see what's going on in your neighborhood. Because I might see something in my neighborhood. You know, let's say I have 20, 30 houses in my neighborhood. I really only pay attention to my neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know which cars are in my neighborhood. I look for people sitting in neighborhoods. But overall, I don't know what's going on down the street.
You know, I think a starting point, and it might be a separate topic, is, you know, I always look at, especially where my nieces live because they're younger, you know, who are the registered sex offenders? And I don't mm-hmm. think there's any capable, or I don't think there's any way of doing this. Maybe there is, but like seeing, okay, who are the houses that have these foster, not foster kids, but like the kids that are being
The
planted.
UACs, yeah.
Yeah, I don't even know
or
if that would be legal.
Unaccompanied migrants, now they're called mm-hmm. unaccompanied children. I think they're using unaccompanied children. They changed the name.
I just think that might draw in more predators to that site. Like, okay, there's little kids here. You know what I mean? But I don't know what the starting point would be, but it just seems so overwhelming. I know Glover recently went to the southern border with Sheriff Lamb and he was blown away, you know, and then, mm-hmm. you know, you're seeing that, you know, gates are welded open. And I saw recently a report of people in railroad carts that were designed for like coal being shipped right to the border. And it's like, whoa. And then, you know, a buddy of mine, Craig Caudill, he runs a tracking program out of Kentucky. You know, he said, look, even the people that are walking across the desert with the carpet on their feet, they can be found if you know how to track them. Like the inexperienced tracker. Usually. Yeah. Inexperienced tracker.
Yeah, the carpet thing is like, it's just, it's a, they think they're not going to be tracked, but it's just as easy to track them with a carpet on their feet.
So I gotta ask you about something because this is a something that was happening on the northern border. And, you know, the southern border is always in the news, but, you know, I used to teach survival skills up in Chateauguay, New York, and we had a pretty good relationship with the local border patrol guys. And they told us that there's trafficking that's happening on the northern border where a lot of the indigenous will have contacts overseas and they will say to a family in China or in India, hey, do you want to go to New York? And everyone thinks, oh, New York City, big metropolis, right? Well, we can disappear over there. Well, they would pay $1,000. Here are these shipping containers or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. They'd get dropped off on the northern border and they'd say, walk 100 feet through those woods, you'll be in New York. And when they walk through the 100 feet of woods and they cross the border, they cross the slash, which is clear cut. You can hear helicopters coming for miles, but they cross over into the US. They're actually in upstate New York, north of the Adirondacks, and now they're wandering around. I mean, the northern border, it blows my mind how insecure the northern border is.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and the southern border is the focus, but Canada is very, very tolerant of a lot of people like coming in and, hey, you know, if you cross into the US, go ahead. But when you cross back into Canada, that's when they run your passports on buses. And
oh, yeah.
Like there's nothing stopping people from Canada from coming to the United States. Like it's so easy. But yeah, the other way is
it's completely open. And, you know, when you talk about a lot of people understand, especially us on the East Coast, is imagine driving down Route 95 from Maine to Miami. Mm. That is the length of the southern border. Can you imagine putting up a wall or any trying to secure that? There's no way.
Man,
walls do work in certain areas, but the northern border has nothing.
Nothing, like,
absolutely nothing. You can walk through any. Where do you want to go?
Yeah,
and you know, you just come in wherever you need.
And we got a bunch of funny stories about the northern border because my late mentor Marty had about, I want to say it was 300 yards of his 520 acres that he owned up there. He had 300 yards or so that were all northern border shared with Canada, and there was that slash. And my God, like. The sensors were not camouflaged, and the sensors had paths that you could walk right up to them to change the batteries easily. And it was like, because they cut this huge slash, like I said, you could hear the helicopters coming, so you could hide from them easily. And then The other thing was they would patrol on ATVs. Well, you could hear a chainsaw go down sound corridor, you know? So I don't know what the solution is for the northern border, but We used to rib our northern border border patrol buddies. We had a guy named Willie. I won't give his last name, but we used to joke with Willie, like, Willie, why are you Mexican working on the northern border? you're a Spanish speaker, exactly. You know. But man, that I don't envy those guys that have to do that job, because every once in a while they do find something, you know, pretty incredible up there, and then it's like, okay, well, if they were able to find that one, how many didn't they find? You know. It blows my mind.
Oh man. And when you think about what's coming across the border, mm-hmm. It's not necessarily, you know, Central and South Americans, it's every nationality. That's one thing I worked with Senator Grassley's office on too, was that back when I did it was Syria was a hotbed. So what were we doing about the Syrians coming across the border and those coming from special interest countries, you know, with ties to terrorism? There's so much coming across the border.
So what's
and you
typical?
Know just as well as I do, like When it comes to vetting, mm-hmm. If someone has never been encountered by the IC, the intelligence community, or law enforcement, and they have a quote unquote credible story, there's no vetting.
Yeah,
you can't just tell someone's a criminal just if they've never been encountered by anybody before.
Yep. Same reason why universal background checks, when politicians push for those for gun control, it's like, does it work for someone who has never committed a crime, but is about to, because, you know, he or she, like their wife, or their husband just did X, Y, Z. And now they're going to, you know what I mean? Like it, I laugh at that. It's like, if they have no record, that background check means absolutely nothing. And it's just going to tie up law enforcement from doing their job on what they know is effective.
And foreign law enforcement's not sharing everything, or some of them aren't sharing anything with us. So it's like, you know, anybody and everybody who's coming across the border.
Mm-hmm. What's the most common country that they would fly into, and how does that work? Like they fly from the Middle East into, maybe not necessarily Mexico, but like, do they fly?
No, they fly into Brazil.
Okay.
And then Brazil, they get handed over to a different smuggler. So you have different branches of smuggling operations. Like, you know, you'll have the foreign branch will get them on the plane, get them to Brazil. Brazil, you'll have a guy who will get them to Central America, who will then get them through Guatemala into Mexico. So the same corridors. I mean, there's these smuggling corridors that you just come straight up. And you were talking about the train. There's trains called La Bestia, the Beast. Mm-hmm. And that's what will bring migrants straight up to, you know, Mexico, everywhere up into Mexico. And they just make it, brother. I mean, everybody and anybody, a lot of it comes in through Brazil and up through these same trafficking corridors.
Man, I got to talk to my girlfriend. She's Brazilian. Her mother's actually flying back to Brazil today. But I think the two of you would have a heck of a conversation, since her background is in Homeland Security as well. And I'm sure you guys would definitely chat it up. I'll have to connect you guys on social. But so I know you've got a busy day today, and I appreciate you coming on. There's clearly so much more that people can do to follow this and to become educated and whatnot. What are some of the resources people should check out? Where can they follow you, and how can they get in touch with you if they have something that's super pressing that they need to reach out to you about?
Well, I'm on the gram a lot, Instagram. So, mm-hmm. I mean, at Dr. Jason Piccolo. And then, you know, my contact, my DMs are always open. And most of that, my podcast is called The Protectors Podcast. I do that all the time. But hey, I'm going to, you know, pretty much you could find me anywhere. And then I'm always open to talk about this and everything else. I have an article coming out about the kids next month in Ballistic Magazine. So, yeah, man, always open to talk about this and everything, brother.
Yeah, and let's not forget that you might be found on the firing line during a shotgun class with Jerry. You know, but I do want to get you out to a personal security class, because
I do want to do the personal security. I think that'd be incredible, man.
Yeah, it's eye-opening for people who have never, you know, had a shoot, no shoot scenario and never learned de-escalation or how to create space or learn how to retreat, or, you know, just have that tunnel vision kick in when the adrenaline spikes. And people think like, oh, you know, the adrenaline, how can you really do that when there's a guy in a padded suit and you're shooting, whether it's airsoft, sims, or cert pistols? It's like, trust me, when that role player engages you and starts talking trash and, you know, takes up that space and now starts cutting off avenues of escape, like, we've had people say that, like, they're redlining, you know? So I really am excited for you to see that and get to know Jerry. Cause again, Jerry's a good dude, and you guys will kick, you know, hit it off really, really, really well. But, Jason, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. And I hope everyone that's listening will listen to, you know, Jason's podcast, check out all of the work that he's doing. He's doing good work for, you know, our country. And like I said, please keep your eyes open in your own neighborhood, cause something could be happening under your own nose. And hopefully, you know, you guys will learn something from this and apply it. But hopefully that never actually needs to be done. Hopefully everything, you know, stays above board in your neighborhood. But Jason, thank you again so much for joining us. And until next time, guys, thank you so much for listening to the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast.